Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Lots of good information coming your way today. Always starting with the latest on health and healing. We're going to look at how to strike at the root cause of cancer malignancy from Sarah G. of Green Med Info. We're also going to talk about calendula. It's very important for your skin and your heart. We're also going to look at a question that a lot of people have not answered. What happens when you smoke a lot of marijuana? I'll give you the science on that. There is a chemical in onion. It's called alum, and it can do some wonderful things. I'll tell you about that. I'll also get into what you should know before eating any more seafood. Now, from our environmental segment, we have a lot also we're going to talk about, including the latest on the drought in California, and it's gotten worse since Friday. I'll tell you what's wrong there. Also, a statement from some major scientists on a climate change panel, the Intergovernmental Climate Change Panel, quote, "Act now or pay the heaviest price," and that's from a leaked climate report. "Explicit efforts must be taken to reduce emissions." Or what? We'll see. Also from our public health segment today, we'll take a look at several issues, including why French kids don't get ADHD, the antibody deception, and how a sleeping product, very popular sleeping product, quote, "America's number one prescription sleep aid could trigger zombies, murder, and other disturbing behavior," by Allison McCabe from thefix.com. This is based upon good science. So just when they're referring to zombies, they're referring to, in this case, where a person could do something violent and wouldn't remember that they had done it. We'll get into that. And special commentaries today, because I've decided not to have a guest so I can share these commentaries. My own commentaries that I wrote yesterday, plus from Ralph Nader. America's Invisible and Costly Human Rights Crisis, from Michael Payne. Monumental Unrestrained Military Spending is Crippling America. And also from Professor Henry Giroux, Reclaiming the Radical Imagination, Challenging Casino Capitalism's Punishing Factories, from Truth Out. Let's begin. I talk a lot about turmeric because there's probably 2,000 studies that I have from peer-reviewed literature on how well it works in your body. Now we find that it can also be a very important factor dealing with the basis of most cancers, especially the malignancies. According to the peer-reviewed literature article, Cancer Letters, turmeric is, in this article, the title is Targeting Cancer Cells by Curcumin in Clinical Applications. And U.S. researchers evaluated the primary polyphenol in turmeric called curcumin. So you have the herb itself, turmeric. You have an active ingredient in it called curcumin. And that's what targets cancer stem cells, which are believed to be at the root of the cause of cancer formation and malignancy. Now, according to Sayre G., whereas conventional models of cancer assumed that the majority of the cancer cells within a tumor possesses self-renewal capabilities to differing degrees, that is all part of how you get cancer. You get inflammation from something in your diet. Maybe it's coffee or alcohol. Maybe it's all those pizzas or fried food. Maybe it's the salami. Whatever inflammatory agents you've taken in is probably accumulation of all of them. One day you've damaged the cell so much it can't repair itself. And then the tumor manifests. And then there's this whole apex of hierarchical communications of cells within the tumor. And they're called the mother. And the various daughter cells that make it up, most of which are intrinsically benign. Now, conventional treatment with chemotherapy and radiation based upon the models currently used, they will try to kill as many of these cells as possible. But then you have turmeric, and it works differently. Here's what's really remarkable about it and curcumin. They did this study, and they found that turmeric and curcumin have the ability to kill various cancer cell lines. In fact, the literature is so abundant that there's over 600 health benefits in the literature on turmeric. And the regulation of this self-renewal pathway, curcumin appears to directly and indirectly influence at least three self-renewal pathways within cancer stem cells. I won't go into the science, but the science is there to support this. So it selectively kills cancer cells, does not hurt healthy cells. That's the difference between chemotherapy and radiation. They kill all the cells in the area. They're virtually indiscriminate. Curcumin only kills cancer cells. That's what makes it so good. And that's what this newest study found. So anyone with cancer, or anyone who feels susceptible to cancer, I would suggest 2,000 milligrams a day to prevent cancer of curcumin. And if you have cancer, then that amount would go up substantially under the care and direction of a qualified licensed practitioner. Calendula. It's good for inflammation, especially helping the skin heal, and it protects the heart. Now, calendula is sometimes also called marigold, and it is a plant that comes from a group that are about 2 feet tall and has beautiful yellow flowers, and originated from Egypt and certain parts of southern Europe, but now it's grown all over the world. It's been known to help eczema, gastritis, conjunctivitis, minor burns like sunburns, warts, sprains. In fact, you'll see calendula cream for athletes to put on small wounds. And now the University of Connecticut School of Medicine experimented in the laboratory and found that it has cardioprotective benefits, so especially when faced with ischemic heart disease. The calendula effect turned out to be very beneficial, mainly by stimulating aortic flow as well as diminishing myocardial infarct size and cardiovascular cell death. So, if you have a problem with your skin, calendula. If you're taking radiation treatments, calendula. If you have a problem with previous heart attack, take calendula, because it can help with all those conditions. A friend of mine, longtime friend, when I first came to the city, I met this man. And he was a regular daily user of marijuana. And he came by the Institute a lot, Institute of Applied Biology. And he would talk about the fact that what it does, it chills people out. If only more people used it, there'd be less violence. It's better than alcohol because it doesn't hurt the liver and the heart. And he was all pro-marijuana. I said, why don't you look at the scientific literature on it? I did, and I came up with 114 separate studies showing the harmful effects of marijuana. But he didn't believe that. I remember broadcasting it, and people, they didn't want to believe it. Fine. But then I began to see in this same person paranoia. I also saw psychotic outbursts, so bad that in time, he ended up having his sons move him out to Hawaii, where he lives now, and because he could do less damage and less embarrassment to everyone. So they support him living in a beautiful little place up in the mountains. Not a bad place to live out your life. And he just could never believe that a lot of his problems, his immunocompromised problems, were due to marijuana. I've talked with his sons. His sons are aware of this. He still refused to acknowledge it. I've seen at least three close friends of mine end up becoming delusional, paranoid, and psychotic. And it wasn't transient. It was permanent. Here's the latest study from the peer-reviewed literature, published in the American Medical Association's Journal's Archives of General Psychiatry. Quote from Will Dunham. Heavy marijuana use shrinks brain parts. Long-term heavy use of marijuana may cause two important brain structures to shrink. Brain scans showed the hippocampus and amygdala were smaller in men who were heavy marijuana users compared to non-users. The men had smoked marijuana daily for 20 years. Now keep in mind, these are the parts of the brain that regulate memory and emotion, and also the amygdala in particular plays a critical role in fear and aggression. And marijuana users are more likely to exhibit mild signs of psychotic disorders, but not enough to formally be diagnosed with any such disorder unless they use it heavily. Heavy, where you can actually manifest these symptoms, are 5 joints a day. That's not a lot for those who are using it. So, quote, these findings challenge the widespread perception of cannabis as having limited or no harmful effects on brain and behavior. And this was from the Research Center at the University of Melbourne. Quote, like most things, some people experience greater problems associated with cannabis use than others. Our findings suggest that everyone is vulnerable to potential changes in the brain, some memory problems and psychiatric symptoms, if they use heavily enough and for long enough. So, on the one hand, we have to separate out the issues. Should we criminalize marijuana? Absolutely not. It's just stupid at every level. But it is a very good idea to criminalize marijuana and to put people in jail for as long as humanly possible for possession, even the tiniest amount, if you're a corporatist. If you're a neoliberal person who believes in privatization of our prison system and you're charging the state for every person that's in jail, well, the more people that are in jail, the more money you make. It makes no difference to them whether or not the person just should be in jail or whether they're a risk to society. There just is purely profit. So for them, they're the ones, their lobbyists are ones behind the state legislatures, paying off these legislatures in order to keep these stupid laws on the books. We should free everyone in every jail in the world for these drug possession charges. They're just stupid. But separate from that, if you're going to put a person in jail for using marijuana, what would you do to a person if it's based upon the physical destruction of a person's body and the consequences to them committing acts in aggression or negligence? Then everyone who drinks does 100 times more damage to society. Should you then put everyone who drinks in jail? Well, we tried that. We tried prohibition. Didn't work. Created organized crime. So our entire way that looking at what is a person's right of self-selection has to be re-examined. So if you believe a person has a right to do with their body what they choose, then don't punish them. If they need help, help them. In any case, that's just my opinion. But I have seen the damage it's done. So if people want to live in denial of that damage, let them. You know, yeah. How many times have we seen people, famous people, who had all the resources at their disposal, all the open doors that they needed? They could get to the best and brightest in any field because they're celebrity. Instead, they come from their dark side. They make choices from their insecurity and fears, from their anger and pain, and it costs them dearly and those who are around them. We see that all the time. That's unfortunate. Now, something good from The Onion. Now, I've told you many times that The Onion can help thin the blood. That's good. That helps prevent your red blood cells from aggregating, and that could cause a clump that could cause a blockage in your arteries, causing either a heart attack or stroke. But there's more. They can kill bacteria and viruses. Now, there's new science from article from Pathophysiology, Volume 20, that says common onion extract reverses cadmium-induced organ toxicity via redox alteration. What this means in lay language is that it can help get rid of the cadmium that would otherwise damage your organs. Now, cadmium is a heavy metal like lead and mercury and aluminum, and therefore anything that can get the cadmium out of the body is good. So a natural chelator is onion. We have a lot of people eating seafood. A lot of people make that as a transition going from meat eating to a plant-based diet, thinking, all right, what's safer? And it's not. In fact, from the Environmental Working Group, people who follow the Obama administration guideline on eating seafood could consume, quote, dangerous amounts of mercury, a potent neurotoxin, or too few essential omega-3 fatty acids, according to this new study. Quote, the federal government's advice on seafood consumption fails to give people what they desperately need, precise, detailed information about foods that provide sufficient omega-3 fatty acids with minimal mercury contamination. So what they did was they analyzed the omega-3 concentrations in seafood to see how much you're getting, but also how much mercury you're getting. And it was interesting of how many servings or how many ounces you would have to consume in order to get your omega-3s. So here they are. To get the amount of omega-3 fatty acids, which is about 1,700 milligrams, I believe it should be twice that, you would have to eat up to 8 ounces of salmon, 20 ounces of crab, 20 ounces of light tuna. This is a lot. Pollock, 20, 40, cod, tilapia, 60, catfish, 80, and shrimp, 100. 100 ounces just to get a day's requirement. Now, if you looked at the vegetarian amounts, you could easily obtain that from the omega fatty acids. So for those who are still going to say, well, I want to get my omega-3s from seafood, all right, here's what I would suggest. Your best choices in this order, meaning you can take the least amount of seafood and get the most amount of omega-3 and the least amount of mercury. Your number one choice would be anchovies, herring, salmon, and sardines, in that order. Your worst selection, absolutely worst, would be canned albacore tuna, halibut, mackerel, orange roughy, sea bass, shark, swordfish, tilefish, tuna, snapper, haddock, bass, flatfish, carp, and lobster. You wouldn't want any of those. Very high in mercury. Okay? That way, at least you know, if you're going to do it, where to get it. Now, in a moment, going to, I'll do it right now. I want to give a short but more important piece from Morris Ingleton on turning off your body's aging switch. I thought everybody in this audience would appreciate this, because from the time we're 27, we're officially aging. Yes, that's the latest scientific study. At the biological level, if you're over the age of 27, you are actually now aging. No longer are you in youth. So it's important to understand that we now have the biochemical switches that can turn on many of the chronic diseases of aging, but turn them off as well. I was thinking of this yesterday, because yesterday I did my long run. I tried to get in a 20-mile run because I'm competing in about 3 weeks at the National 20K Championships. I just won a championship about 3 weeks ago, and I'm starting my world game training, and it's a whole long process. It builds up to where you're doing about 6 to 7 hours a day of training. I mean, it's literally Olympic-type training. And so I'm thinking, gee whiz, how many people that I went to high school with or college with or grad school, and they didn't take that opportunity. They just didn't believe it was necessary. They were young and vital and probably in good shape. And then Then it creeps up on you, all those bad choices, including the lack of exercise. And then one day you look in the mirror and you think, oh my God, what happened to my abs? What happened to my body? These are the bad choices. And then the older you get, by the age of 50, you no longer are aware, but almost all the switches in your body are turned to disease. Now, the name of this newly identified switch is called HMBG1. Again, HMBG1, which stands for High Mobility Group Box 1. Now, I'll explain this in lay language. The HMBG1 turns on the release of chemical signals called cytokines. Cyto, C-Y-T-O, kines, K-I-N-E-S. They generate the inflammation in your body. You've heard me mention 1,000 times. It is inflammation that causes virtually all disease. And what causes inflammation can be stress, it can be work environment, it can be pollutants, it can be the debris and clutter in one's life. It can be poor diet, processed foods. All that contributes, and it's generally all the above. Now, the chronic inflammation that you have, the more rapidly your body ages. So the tragic consequence of higher levels of inflammation is the acceleration of chronic diseases that cause premature death and disability. Now, one scientist uncovered the switch that turns on chronic inflammation. They began looking for a safe and effective means of turning off that switch. Well, researchers have found two natural ingredients that can directly control HMGB1, thus reducing the body's exposure to chronic inflammation and ultimately protecting against inflammation-induced disorders. And that is terrific. Now, let me just explain for a moment how HMGB1 triggers inflammation. The molecule is responsible for initiating acute inflammation, which is a helpful reaction when your body is under attack by germs or following an injury. Unfortunately, when a cell is damaged, its contents of this HMGB1 leak out, leading to chronic inflammation. So when HMGB1 leaks out, it acts as a danger signal that triggers the release of chemical signaling molecules called cytokines. They call in more white blood cells, which release still more cytokines in a vicious cycle. At its worst, this activity can result in a massive systemic release of cytokines that can shut down your body's entire system. For example, the deadly SARS outbreak of 2003 is an example of cytokine storm, where it appears victims died as a result of the body's overreaction to the SARS virus and not the virus itself. So fortunately, a true cytokine storm is rare, but the cumulative effects that result from this slowly leaking from our aging cells are too common. Now, in the month of October, recently, I took a group of 10 individuals, all of whom had very pronounced and advanced diseases, medically irreversible, or at least non-treatable by any method to show any improvement. And we had remarkable improvements and changes. We're still in our post-follow-up status from advanced dementia to massive viral overproduction. And all of these have been improved substantially. I turned off the inflammation. So by turning off the inflammation and not contributing to any more inflammation, suddenly the entire body has this enormous burden lifted. And that's been the basis of virtually all my successful work, helping countless people over the decades. Now they're coming up with something similar in a laboratory. Their laboratory experiments have demonstrated that putting the brakes on this inflammation switch is a powerful means of slowing and reversing the process involved in inflammation. And so that's what they're doing. So now, where's the good news? Two things. One, mung beans. Mung, M-U-N-G, the bean, little tiny green bean, and green tea extracts. The two together combat inflammation by interfering at several different points in the cascade of events that lead to the HMBG1 release from stressed or damaged cells. So most of today's anti-inflammatory drugs work on a single target point of inflammation. And nearly all the mung beans' HMGB1 lowering action is found in the seed coat of the bean, a little green tiny coat. In fact, when fed to rats before or after exposure to heat stress, mung bean seed coat extract reduced blood markers of excessive oxidative stress while also strengthening the body's natural antioxidant defense system. And when cells are exposed to bacterial toxins, EGCG, the major beneficial component in green tea, reduces the HMGB1 release from cells in direct proportion to the dose. And it's generally within 2 to 6 hours after exposure. So 3 recent studies demonstrate the dramatic life-saving ability of mung bean seed coat and EGCG from green tea. They all involve sepsis, a condition involving the HMGB1 that kills hundreds of thousands of Americans every year in hospital intensive care units, despite modern antibiotics and life-saving technology. Sepsis is an illness in which the body has a severe systemic inflammatory response to infection. In sepsis, the switch triggers an outpouring of cytokines, and it's this resulting inflammation and not the infecting germ that ultimately kills the patient. So once these cytokines are on the loose, it's typically too late to fight with the anti-cytokine therapies. So that's why get your green tea every day and start eating those little tiny mung bean sprouts. That's the best way of taking them. They're inexpensive. You can sprout them yourself and have yourself some mung bean sprouts every day in your salad. You can slow down the aging process. Remember, anything that turns off inflammation extends the life of the cell. If you want to live a longer life, have less of these pro-inflammatory agents. And so that's that. I'm Gary Noll. We're here to talk about the issues that make a difference in our lives. Everyday information that empowers. Nutrition. We have the most information on health and nutrition of any radio program in the world. Number one in the world. Number one most progressive listened to radio program. And the most on the environment. In fact, time after time, we are always giving the latest on environmental issues in depth. And hopefully people pay attention. Now, It was 5 years ago that I did a report on the 12 tipping points, and that 3 of the 12 were tipping and could not be reversed. Therefore, we would have to prepare for them. And then 2 years ago, I said that there are 16 states in the United States that will not be sustainable based upon what is needed for sustaining a life in the United States, and therefore I would not move to those. Visiting, yes. Vacationing, yes. But I wouldn't move there. I wouldn't buy anything there. And then I did a report, which is free. It's there as a public service. It's up on my website. The most sustainable places in the world to live. And it took almost a year of intensive research to get that for you. So you can go and look at that. I remember saying just 12 months ago that Colorado was not sustainable. They're running out of water. And they're number two. Number one was Oklahoma. Two was Colorado. Texas, at least half the state. California, the entire state, except for the very northern part. Nevada, New Mexico, Arizona, completely dead in the future. And other states as well, including Georgia and northern Florida. And then I said it's going to get to the point at some point in the near future that if you don't look for a new place to relocate, then you're not going to have the same opportunities. You'll be selling in a panic market. You'll wake up one day and you'll suddenly have restrictions on your use, or you can't go outside because the air is too polluted, or it's too hot, or the water is restricted, and the farmland will be dried up and it'll be another dust bowl, because without water, you don't grow grasses. Without grasses, you can't have horses or cattle or sheep, because they're all based upon grass being fed. I said, and it's not going to happen in 20 or 30 years. It's going to happen the next year or two. That was a year ago. When I was in Colorado this past August, I suggested that they pay attention to supporting themselves in case there's ever an emergency. Nobody listened. 7 days later, they had the worst fires in the state's history. 2 months later, they had the worst flooding in the state's entire history. In 1 hour, 20,000 homes were washed away from a 30-foot wall of mud and water that came cascading down from this torrential rain, the most rain ever recorded in that area in a period of 24 hours. Now they pay attention. Now suddenly the Sherry Burnson, who's the head of special programming for events out at PBS, called me out, and I went out and did some programs, and now that survival package, now they're all paying attention. But it took a disaster to make it happen. I mentioned on Friday that there were 11 communities, or 16 communities, in California that were going to run out of water. Today, quote, front page of the New York Times, lack of water has U.S. West faring worst. I'm going to quote this because it's important. Historical drought leads to drastic cutbacks, from Adam Nagurny and Ian Lovett. The punishing drought that has swept California and much of the West is confronting authorities with the worst water shortage this region has faced in more than a century. With near empty reservoirs, parched fields, starving livestock, clouds of smog, and outbreaks of wildfires. With no sign of significant rain, 17 rural communities in the state providing water to 40,000 people are in danger of running out of water in the next 60 to 120 days. California authorities announced Friday that they had, quote, no water left in the state water project. Let me repeat this. California authorities announced Friday they had no water left in the state water project, the main municipal water distribution system to supplement the dwindling supplies of local agencies that serve 25 million people. It is the first time the project has turned off its spigot in its 54-year history. Quote, we are on track for having the worst drought in 500 years, said B. Lynn Ingram, professor of earth and planetary science at the University of California, Berkeley. The state officials said that in the worst case, they would truck drinking water into parched communities and drill additional wells to draw on groundwater. The deteriorating situation is likely to mean the imposition of mandatory water conservation measures for homeowners and businesses who have already been asked to voluntarily reduce their water use by 20%. Already the drought, technically in its third year, is forcing big shifts in behavior. Farmers in rural Nevada said that they had even given up on planting, while ranchers in Northern California and New Mexico said that they were being forced to sell off cattle as fields that should be 4 feet high in grass are blankets of brown and stunted stalks. Continuing on the full page, the next page, the authorities have outlawed fishing and camping in much of California to protect endangered salmon and guard against fire. Many people have said they had already begun to cut back drastically on taking showers, washing their cars, and watering their lawns. Rain and snow showers brought only a temporary relief. I have experienced a really long career in this area. My worry meter has never been this high, said Tim Quinn, executive director of the Association of California Water Agencies, a statewide coalition. We're talking historical drought conditions. No supplies of water in many parts of the state. I repeat, no supplies of water in many parts of the state. My industry job is to try to make sure that these kinds of things never happen, and they're happening. Officials are girding for the kind of geographical, cultural, and economic battles that have long plagued a part of the country that is defined by a lack of water. Between farmers and environmentalists, urban and rural users, and the northern and southern regions of the state. Then it goes on to talk about all these farmers are having to get rid of their cattle. They're stopping farming because they don't. The seeds are not there, and the irrigation's been turned off. Now, we went from 11,000 being affected to 25 million people as of today. 25 million. So just so you understand, they're saying this, I'm not. I quoted verbatim. And they're always going to be more conservative so as not to panic the public. Here's what I predict. So please listen carefully. I would move out of California. It's not going to be livable. You have the earthquake, but forget that. You have massive 12-month fires. Forget that. You have a topography that is just going to be browned, burned, and dry. Forget that. You have Fukushima and radiation hitting your water and your seafood. Forget that. You have the worst congestion of any place in the United States. Forget that. You're just not going to have any water to drink. Remember that. You have over 40 million people living in the state, approximately. Where are you going to put them? What would happen to the real estate market? You have the eighth largest economy in the world as far as the state's revenues on agriculture. It's over, it'll be netting out or grossing out over $15 billion. What's going to happen when those fields cannot be watered? So what do? Do they give the water to the farmers to grow the food? Or do they give it to the urbanites and suburbanites? There's not enough for everyone. Now, there'll never be no water. It's just a matter of the expense of the water, the difficulty of the water, but the natural source of the water, the Sierra Nevadas, the 400-mile range, doesn't have the snowpack, so it's not going to have the melt. Right now, January and February are the two most important snowpack months of the year. This is when the most amount of snow collects in all of America, and that's when the mountains then hold that snow until the spring when it starts to release itself over the next 2 months or 3 months, and then that gives you the overflow of the rivers, the streams, the estuaries, and the groundwater. You don't have it. You can't even ski up in those areas now. So what this means is you're in a permanent drought. It is only going to get worse, and the property values will plummet. And you'll end up having to buy water from private water tanks coming into your communities. As you just heard, they're going to have to tank water. How do you tank water for 25 million people? Today it's 25 million. Today. In a year from now, it'll be 35 million. So you're out of luck. And it's not going to get better, no matter what kind of politics they want to wrap around it. They know that if there's a panic and people begin to leave or businesses begin to leave, there won't be enough property taxes or other taxes to support any of the local infrastructure, and hence the entire system will collapse. I see this happening in Arizona, New Mexico. Albuquerque is gone dry. Santa Fe is gone dry. Santa Fe is a place I wouldn't live in any case because in wintertime you get 20 below zero up there. You're 7,000 feet. And now the worst fires. So just remember, you were given a heads up. Start looking for other places to live. Now, for those of us who were considered, oh, what did one guy do? Stopped me on the street as I was walking up to get a juice. And he said, Gary, you know, stick with nutrition. You know, this thing about, you know, where to live, all that's nonsense. I says, nonsense? I said, where do you live? He said, I live over on 89th in Riverside Drive. I said, that's a nice area. I said, I used to live on 89th in Riverside when I first came to the city. A little tiny apartment on the ground floor, about 300 square feet. I said, so you have the Hudson River, you have the Adirondacks, you have the Wauquill water up there. You don't have any problem. Have you been to the places I've been? Have you been to over 1,000 towns and cities and communities in the United States? I have. Have you spoken with the people? Do you know what's going on out there? So for those people who don't have the advantages of having everything that you have, I'm talking for them. Not a message you need to hear. Don't listen to it. In the interim, those of us, myself included, have made our moves. We got all the water in the world, perfect land, beautiful communities, beautiful places. No, we'll keep a quality of life going fine, and other people who have got their heads up in the air and looking ahead will also. That's our environmental report. Now from Ralph Nader. And then I'm going to open this up to our talkback segment, where you have an opportunity to call in. Our talkback segment is 888-874-4888. And this is from Countercurrents, Ralph Nader, the article which will be posted with about 80 other articles, as we do every single day. Only progressive, not liberal, not conservative, not corporatized, really empowering progressive articles are on our website, as are documentaries and calls to actions. This is called America's Invisible and Costly Human Rights Crisis. Quote, when the news broke years ago that U.S. forces were using torture on prisoners at Guantanamo Bay detention camp, many politicians and the public expressed appropriate horror. There was shock and disappointment that our country would resort to such inhumane, abusive actions against our fellow human beings, most of whom were simply innocent victims of bounty hunters in Afghanistan. With this frame of reference in mind, it is unfortunate that many Americans do not contemplate or are simply unaware of blatant torture occurring in prisons every day right here in the United States. This form of physical and psychological violence is called many things. It's called isolation, administrative segregation, control units, secure housing, and by its most well-known designation, solitary confinement. This practice of imprisonment is widely used across our nation with disturbingly little oversight and restriction. The full extent of the use of solitary confinement is truly alarming. It is most certainly a human rights abuse and a blight to our national character. Imagine yourself being locked in a small windowless room for days and weeks or years, perhaps even for the majority of your life. You receive food and water through a small slot and have no contact with another human. You might go weeks without speaking to anyone. You're allowed out for perhaps 1 hour a day for some exercise in a controlled area. This is the living reality of tens of thousands of Americans in our prison system. Self-mutilation and suicide attempts among those in solitary confinement are far too common. Not surprisingly, studies have shown that the majority of prison suicides are inmates who are being held in solitary. Many more studies have shown that solitary confinement has a severe psychologically damaging effect on human beings. For prisoners already suffering from mental illness, it exacerbates their problems. Senator John McCain wrote of his experience in solitary confinement as a prisoner of war in Vietnam, quote, it crushes your spirit and weakens your resistance more effectively than any other form of mistreatment. Many might dismiss and even justify punishment by solitary confinement by convincing themselves that those subject to it are bad people. But this is a gross misunderstanding of its common use in our prisons. Many prisoners are held in solitary confinement because they're mentally ill, they're mentally handicapped, or they're illiterate. Some are placed in solitary purportedly for their safety, to protect them from themselves or from other prisoners. Some are put in solitary are children as young as 14. What type of prison infrastructure would result in a 14-year-old being locked up in solitary? Journalist James Ridgway calls the use of solitary confinement a second sentence. The first sentence is, of course, being sent to prison. The second sentence is totally decided by the warden and guards without applicable criteria. As such, the act of disobeying instructions or vaguely interpreting prison rules or the whim of the warden can warrant a lengthy stay in solitary. The lack of accountability in this area is notorious and critical. For many prisoners, a stay in solitary is a death sentence. Ridgway, along with Gene Casella, founded Solitary Watch in 2009. Their goal was to bring attention to what really goes on in American prisons, which are subjected to so little public exposure on their daily operations. And remember, the United States is the world's leader in locking people up. There are currently 2.3 million imprisoned people in the United States, almost one quarter of them for nonviolent drug offenses. This victims of the insatiable prison industrial complex, which costs taxpayers billions of dollars every year. Of these millions of inmates, it is estimated as many as 80,000 are being held in solitary confinement, according to Solitary Confinement Watch. So just want you to know that this is a story that doesn't get told and most people do not know. Now, a few words, and then we'll take a break and come back. Oh, by the way, on tonight's Progressive Commentary, which, by the way, is the most downloaded and listened to program that I do on the radio. Last week it was peak water. Today it's peak soil and food. What we should know about sustainability of the world's food supply. And Jeffrey Smith will be on. We have a whole magnificent panel on. So you should please pay attention, 7 o'clock on this radio. A society is only as viable as it is free to make important choices that empower its citizens. The Gilded Age is back, with huge profits from the ultra-rich hedge fund managers and the major players in the financial services industry. In the new landscapes of wealth, exclusion, and fraud, the commanding institutions of a savage and fanatical capitalism promote a winner-take-all ethos and aggressively undermine the welfare state and wage a counter-revolution against the principles of social citizenship and democracy. The geographies of moral and political decadence have become the organizing standard of the dream worlds of consumption and privatization and surveillance and degradation. For instance, banks such as J.P. Morgan Chase, Bank of America, and other investment companies, including Barclays, Citigroup, Deutsche Bank, Goldman Sachs, and UBS, prosper. How? By subterfuge and corruption. Those are the only two virtues that they understand, negative, immoral virtues. They also have been transformed into punishing factories that erode the welfare state while pushing millions into hardship and misery and relegating an entire generation of young people into a state of massive unemployment and debt and repression. The profits seem endless, and the lack of moral responsibility unchecked as the rich go on buying sprees, soaking up luxury goods in record numbers. The New York Times reports that dealers of high-end luxury cars cannot keep up with the demand, including the indulging in luxury items, which is no longer a dirty word for the ultra-rich in spite of living in a society of racked, massive unemployment, inequality, and poverty. For example, the Times talk without irony or criticism about Matt Haviland, an entrepreneur in Cleveland who owns 7 businesses, mostly in manufacturing. He bought 3 Mercedes last year, and then it goes in to talk about the prices the Times quoted him as. Well, this example of shameless consumption reads like a scene out of Martin Scorsese's film The Wolf of Wall Street, which portrays the financial elite as infantilized frat boys out of control in their unquenchable craving for greed, sex, power, and every other debauchery imaginable. At a time when the United States has descended into forms of political and moral amnesia, massive inequality and high levels of poverty, coupled with narratives of excess and over-the-top material indulgence, what have we become? This has all been normalized. There's no critical commentary in the mainstream media on this, but it gets worse. As the zombies of casino capitalism rake in unprecedented amounts of wealth, they appear to take delight in mocking and humiliating the poor and the disadvantaged as if they are not responsible for their suffering but deserve such hardships in spite of the fact that they are not accountable for the difficulties in which they find themselves. Those with little power or wealth are now seen not only as morally degenerate but also as disposable, subject to the whims of the market and outside any consideration of compassion or justice. Yet there is more at work here than a moral deficit or the kind of pathological daring and willingness to remove oneself from any sense of compassion for others. There is also a culture of cruelty willfully reproduced by a rabid form of casino capitalism that measures human worth in cost-benefit analysis and accrues and consolidates power in the interest of the top 1% of the population. The new extremists balk at extending unemployment benefits or providing food stamps for younger children, yet they have no trouble offering hundreds of millions and billions of dollars to corporate interest or lowering taxes on the ultra-rich corporations as if they pay any taxes at all now, which most don't. Obscene wealth couples with the arrogance of power as billionaires such as the Koch brothers make $3 million net profit an hour from their investments while simultaneously calling for the abolishment of the minimum wage. CEO salaries reached into the financial stratosphere while the middle and working classes increasingly face impoverishment and misery. And yet, that's the way it's become. And it shouldn't be that way. Republicans claim they are now concerned about addressing poverty, especially since the general public rightly views them as heartless, cruel, and indifferent to the hardships experienced by people who are unemployed and lack food, shelter, and health care, and any sense of hope. Yet the hypocrisy of the apostles of casino capitalism is on full display in how they go about doing anything, always with the idea corporate interests first. We now live under a form of casino capitalism that reveals in itself the deception. It kills the radical imagination. It depoliticizes the American public and promulgates what might be called disimagination factories and punishing machines. Idealism has been replaced by repressive punishment and a surveillance state that turns every space into a war zone, criminalizes social problems, and legitimizes state violence as the most important practice for addressing important social issues. Racism now fuels a massive incarceration system that expands the reach of the punishing state to those viewed as excess and excluded from American society. The carceral state and the surveillance state now work together in trumpeting security over freedom and justice while solidifying the rule of the financial elite and the reigning financial services such as banks, investment houses, the hedge funds, all of which profit from the expanding reach of the punishing state. The drug war has become a war on racial minorities. Just the war on poverty became a war on the poor. In conclusion, Chris Hedges is right when he argues that any state that has the capacity to monitor all of its citizens, any state that has the ability to snuff out factual public debate through the control of information, any state that has the tools to instantly shut down all dissent is totalitarian. And while Hedges is aware that this disciplinary culture of fear and repression is rooted in a political economy that treats people as objects and makes the accumulation of capital the subjects of history, he underestimates one important element of the new authoritarianism produced by casino capitalism, that is, what is moved about existing registers of discipline and control is that they operate in a new historical conjecture in which the relationship among political power, cultural institutions, and everyday life has become more powerful and intense in the ability to undermine the radical imagination and the power and capacities of individuals to resist repression and make the crucial decisions necessary to take control over the forces that shape their lives. The machineries of public power and consent have taken on an Orwellian presence in the age of digital technologies, and when challenged to authoritarian rule emerges, the state resorts to the only thing it can, unapologetic repression of all critical thought and dissent. Let us take, in the final moments here, some calls, your opportunity to call in for TalkBack, 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888. I'm Gary Nall, and each day, a different commentary. Each day, some different insights into the human dynamics. And I will be dealing on our Progressive Commentary Hour with what is happening to our food. As I've explained that we're running out of water, I will now explain that we're running out of good land in order to produce the type of foods necessary to sustain a society. Let us now say hello to Luann Panessi, who's standing by. Hi, Luann.
Hello, Gary. I have an email here from Chris from Pennsylvania. He says, first, thank you for your work on PRN and especially for the call-in number to hear the shows. He says, I'm a big bottled water drinker. He says, I just found out that the Environmental Protection Agency oversees our municipal water quality, yet the FDA oversees bottled water production. and it seems that they're doing a poor job. It doesn't seem right to me. I also found out the facts about the sources of bottled water. Most of them are not from the mountains and the streams that the ads represent. They're actually from industrial bottling plants in cities like places in Ohio, northern Los Angeles, and he puts yuck in parentheses, and Corpus Christi, Texas. And yet they take tap water and pass it through charcoal filters, and it goes through steam distillation. And many of them have been reported to contain harmful bacteria. Could that be? If it's true, this is an outrage and false advertising. He says, I appreciate that we're having water issues, especially in some of these areas, but what gives? He says, what brands do you recommend or use, and should I even be drinking bottled water at all?
If you're going to drink bottled water, either drink it from a biodegradable and hence recyclable plastic or from glass. Secondly, only drink that water which comes from aquifers, deep aquifers. Now, spring water comes from aquifers. Hence, the spring originates from a prehistoric aquifer and comes up to the surface. That's where you should get your water. Do not drink any water that is simply tap water that has been put into, in effect, if someone came into your house and said, we're going to start bottling your tap water and put a label on it, and that's what they do. That's the majority of the water that people are drinking out there. They're just not aware of it. So it must come from natural sources. It must state the mineral content and antibacterial content and know the source of the mineral water that you're drinking. Where does it come from? Then it's fine. Otherwise, I would never drink water that is tap water that is so-called purified.
A lot of them have it right on the bottle. I found out that they say right on the bottle, bottled in a municipal, from municipal waters.
People don't realize what they're reading, though.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Okay.
Let's say hello to you, Therese Lead. Hi, you, Therese.
Hello, Gary. Today, we're following up on the story. We began on Friday. We're talking about eyewitness accounts of the FBI raid on a small software development company that developed a product that the FBI itself had tried to develop and couldn't, not even after $178 million in 3 years.
What's the name of that company?
So we're getting eyewitness testimony today.
What is the name of that company?
It's called IRP for a short.
We'll look forward to it right now, you Therese Lead.
The girl's got plenty good lovin'.